Thank you for joining us today on School Care Matters. In this series, we're unpacking the Indiana Department of Education's 7 social emotional competencies. I'm Shane Presley, and I'm joined today by Tina Woldridge of the School Care team. Tina is a social emotional wellness specialist and regional trainer for the Sources of Strength Wellness Program in Northeast Indiana. Welcome. This is the final podcast in a series of discussions about the SEL competencies. The last time you both shared a number of strategies to increase students' critical thinking skills.
We did. Shane, do you remember how many decisions we make every day?
35,000.
That's right. We said that critical thinking helps us sift through our available options and choose the best one. Mm-hmm. We mentioned 3 simple practices to prepare our bodies and brains for decision making: getting enough water, sleep, and exercise. Then we suggested reducing the number of daily decisions you make by simplifying your wardrobe, your routine, and your menu. And we recommended the TED-Ed video, 5 Tips to Improve Your Critical Thinking.
Right.
We ended by talking about the value of quality questions in the classroom and teaching students to detect faulty logic and challenge their own assumptions.
Right. So today's topic is the last of the 7 social-emotional competencies. Mindset. What do we mean by mindset?
We're defining it as the ability to practice cognitive flexibility and willingness to learn. Mindset has also become synonymous with terms like grit and resilience.
Now, I'm surprised that this is the last competency to be taught.
Yeah, I think that's because it requires a degree of higher order thinking that, if you recall, we and our students are only able to engage in once we've addressed the other competencies.
Yeah, that makes sense. So how do we know if we have mindset?
I would start by saying that there are simple assessments available online to help you determine if you tend toward a fixed or a growth mindset.
I recently took that assessment. It seems like someone with a growth mindset believes that through effort or grit, people can develop their intelligence, that people become better at skills through hard work, and that it's important to accept feedback.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I'm guessing that you have a strong growth mindset.
Thank you.
Someone with a healthy mindset will also be able to develop a plan for accomplishing a goal that acknowledges motivation, one's strengths and areas of growth, potential for challenge or failure, and moral implications.
There's a lot there. So let's start with cognitive flexibility.
Someone who's developed cognitive flexibility can adapt quickly to changes or new situations, see issues from different points of view, respond well to errors, tolerate change, and navigate transitions well.
Let's talk about transitions.
So transitions can include everything from navigating between tasks to moving from one classroom to another to progressing to the next grade level or school building. These transitions often lead to dysregulation, especially for students who have work to do around developing cognitive flexibility. So teachers who can help students to anticipate and navigate transitions well will likely have calmer classrooms, and they'll spend less time addressing disruptive behaviors.
What can teachers do to facilitate smoother transitions?
Well, it could be as simple as alerting students to an upcoming transition and reminding them to use the strategies they've identified as effective for navigating the transition successfully.
That sounds extremely empowering. The second part of the definition of mindset was willingness to learn. Can you speak more about that?
Yeah, some students come into the classroom with more natural curiosity than others.
Yes.
Those students tend to do better as independent learners. But teachers and parents can find ways to foster willingness to learn, whether a student or their child is naturally curious or a more reluctant learner.
So how do we do that?
Well, there are a few fairly obvious strategies, like focusing on their areas of interest. You could find ways to incorporate characters from popular video games into math problems, or have students create a TikTok video to summarize a book they've read. Another idea is to share stories about your own enthusiasm for learning. If you have an example of a time when you personally benefited from learning something new, that can be a powerful motivator for reluctant learners. Mm. Also, I think students at every level enjoy game-based learning. Mm-hmm. Games have a way of making learning fun and lowering stress. Studies have shown that when we're calm and relaxed, we're more likely to retain new information. Mm,
true.
Finally, I would recommend emphasizing the idea of multiple intelligences.
What do you mean by multiple intelligences?
So it's a theory that was proposed in the 1980s by developmental psychologist Howard Gardner that essentially broadened the definition of intelligence. In my classroom, I introduced the theory of multiple intelligences by asking students to respond to the question, are you smart? Hmm. How would you answer that, Shane?
I would say yes, I believe I'm smart.
Well, good. I tell my students that the answer to the question is always yes. Every student in every classroom should respond affirmatively to that question. Hmm. Gardner's model includes 8 different types of intelligence or categories of intellectual competence. Those include linguistic, mathematical, naturalistic, visual, musical, inter and intrapersonal, and kinesthetic.
Wow.
After studying the model, I would shift the question and ask my students, how are you smart?
I like that. Mm-hmm. Now, where could someone find out more about multiple intelligences?
LiteracyNet has a great online multiple intelligences tool that will help you to identify how you are smart. Hmm. And then it generates a report based on your results, and that will offer you insights and suggestions for how to use that information to your greatest advantage as a learner.
Hmm. That sounds like a great resource. Mm-hmm. Now that we've unpacked the definition of mindset, let's talk more about what it looks like.
So we said that people who have cultivated mindset are able to develop a plan for accomplishing a goal that acknowledges motivation, one's strengths and areas of growth, potential for challenge or failure, and moral implications.
Hmm. Well, let's first talk about motivation.
So what would you say motivates you?
I would say my family and the desire to be better than I was yesterday.
Mm-hmm. So there's an entire field devoted to studying and leveraging people's motivations. One simple model states that most people are primarily motivated by a desire to do one of 3 things: affiliate, achieve, or affect.
Hmm.
People who are motivated to affiliate are social and relational. They network well, and they collaborate easily with others. These students work well on group projects. Mm. People who are motivated to achieve are good at setting and meeting goals. They tend to be more competitive and action-oriented. These are the students who are anxious when they receive a 98% on an assignment.
Mm.
And then finally, people who are motivated to affect are likely to value social justice and culture change. They're devoted to causes that make the world a better place for everyone. These students need to know the why.
Mm.
The more we can show them how classroom content connects to meaningful change, the more they'll buy into the learning process.
Mm. That's really interesting. I would say that I identify most with being motivated to achieve out of those choices.
Mm-hmm. Another way to think about motivation is intrinsic versus extrinsic.
Hmm.
Simply stated, people who are extrinsically motivated tend to engage in activities or perform tasks in order to earn recognition and awards or to avoid punishment.
Hmm.
While those who are intrinsically motivated are more likely to engage in activities or to perform tasks for their own sake or for personal rewards.
I can see how it would be helpful to consider what motivates us and our students.
Mm-hmm.
Next, you mentioned acknowledging one's strengths and areas of growth.
Yes, those who have developed mindset can factor in their own strengths and growth opportunities, as well as the potential for challenge or failure when they're planning to accomplish a goal.
Mm.
We already talked about multiple intelligences, which is an example of understanding our strengths.
Mm-hmm.
Most people are able to identify what they're good at. It's a little more challenging to identify our growth opportunities.
Mm. Yeah, it seems like that's where accepting feedback comes in.
Exactly. Developing mindset involves effectively accepting and offering constructive feedback.
Mm.
This could be formalized, like peer critiques or rubrics, but it also includes being able to speak up when you witness bullying or to acknowledge that you've messed up when someone points it out to you.
And what about the potential for challenge or failure? How does that relate to mindset?
Have you ever heard of the zone of proximal development?
I remember it from one of my college courses.
Mm-hmm. So it's a theory developed by social psychologist Lev Vygotsky that differentiates and graphically depicts in three rings the tasks a learner can already do unassisted, tasks that are currently beyond their reach, mm-hmm. and then the zone of proximal development in the middle, which represents tasks a learner can do with assistance.
Right.
Another way of visualizing that concept is that our goal is to move learners out of their comfort zone and into the learning or growth zone while avoiding the panic zone.
Avoiding the panic zone sounds like the goal.
Yeah, it is. So let me share a personal example. I've always wanted to zip line.
Okay.
My kids had a zip line that connected two trees in our backyard. So using that zip line was certainly in my comfort zone. Mm-hmm. The panic zone could represent a place in Canada where you can zip line between two mountain peaks that are more than half a mile apart and where zipping speed reaches over 60 miles per hour.
Yeah, I would say that certainly sounds like the panic zone.
Yes, it would be for me right now. So the zone of proximal development or the learning or growth zone is what I did a couple of weekends ago when I had an opportunity to zip across a small lake in Michigan. Mm. It pushed me out of my comfort zone, but avoided forcing me into the panic zone.
Wow. Sometimes it's hard to step out of the comfort zone and into the growth zone. So what are some ways we can push ourselves and our students to do exactly that?
Well, usually we aren't willing to step out of our comfort zone because of what we believe or tell ourselves.
Mm, true.
The Indiana Department of Education provides a great resource called 9 Reframing Questions We Can Ask Ourselves and Our Students When We Are Having Unhelpful Thoughts. Mm.
I like the expression unhelpful thoughts because it focuses on the effect the thoughts have on us instead of assigning value judgment to the person having the thoughts. Mm-hmm. So what are the reframing questions?
So here's the list of the 9 reframing questions. What are other ways of looking at this situation? Am I looking at the whole picture? What might be a more helpful way of picturing this situation? What is the probability that my thoughts will happen? What are some other things that could happen that are equally or more probable? Have I had any experience in the past that suggests that this thought might not be completely true all of the time? Can I really predict the future? Is it helpful to try? And what can I do instead? Could I be exaggerating how bad the result could be? What might be more realistic? Can I read people's minds? What else could they be thinking? And finally, what would I tell a friend if they had this thought?
Those sound like some really helpful questions. You said the final indicator for someone who has developed mindset is that they consider moral implications as they plan how to accomplish a goal.
Yep.
Should it be a teacher's role to determine for students what's considered moral behavior?
Well, when we talked about critical thinking, we recommended that educators focus on teaching students how to think, not what to think.
Yeah, I recall that.
The same holds true when we consider ethics. Our job isn't to provide students with a list of ethical and unethical behaviors. It's to model and teach students how to navigate their own moral decision-making process.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Jana Lone, the director of University of Washington's Center for Philosophy for Children, says it's important for students to learn to search for and evaluate their assumptions, to excavate the reasons behind those assumptions, to examine without prejudice another's opinion, and to make a thoughtful decision with confidence.
Wow. That sounds like a big job. How can we help students and ourselves learn to do those things?
One simple exercise, especially for older students, is to guide them through a process of identifying their core values.
What do you mean by core values?
Well, core values are a way of describing who we are at our core. They represent our line in the sand, or what we're willing and unwilling to accept. Teachers or parents could examine a list of core values with their students or their children and ask them to highlight the ones that resonate. If you engage in this exercise, be careful to highlight the core values that you actually live by, not those you believe others think you should live by. After you've highlighted all of the values that resonated with you, narrow the list down to about 3 to 5 core values. Then you can have a discussion about how the students would define each of those core values and when they think it would be beneficial to practice them.
I've actually done something similar to that, and it was insightful. Now, you mentioned before that educators may struggle with the idea that SEL belongs in the classroom. Could the same be said about ethics?
It could. And again, I would reframe that objection. If we had evidence that ethics training improved academic performance, do you think educators and administrators would be more willing to make space for ethics in the classroom?
Probably.
The truth is that there is extensive evidence that ethics improve academic performance. The truth is that there is extensive evidence that ethics improve academic performance. Data from several research projects show a direct correlation.
Wow.
Interestingly, most of the better-known studies were conducted in other countries, not in the United States, which may reveal a need to devote more time and resources to ethics training in our schools.
That's really interesting. Do you happen to have some examples?
I do. A few years ago, Scotland undertook nationwide substantial curriculum reform, particularly to address the outcome that students would become responsible citizens.
I would say that's an important goal in the U.S. as well.
Right. So this study evaluated the use of philosophical inquiry as a tool to enhance citizenship attributes. The findings revealed that students made significant cognitive, social, and ethical gains in terms of improvement in the quality of explanations they provided when asked to make decisions on how to act in specific situations after 9 weeks of participation in ethical inquiry in the classroom.
Wow. Now, I know I've never done anything to this effect, but it seems like it could be really helpful with processing information.
You know, I've heard that from many students. So another study in Australia showed that standardized test scores for even young children who studied ethics increased in verbal, nonverbal, and quantitative reasoning.
Wow.
The researchers claim that participation in ethical inquiry discussions led to a significant change in students' ability to evaluate arguments and to produce higher quality arguments. A final study conducted at Penn State revealed that even preschoolers can engage with and learn from simple ethical instruction.
Wow.
The study compared pre- and post-interviews with three-year-old children who received ethics instruction. These students gained understanding of the perspective of others and offered more potential solutions to empathy and perspective-based dilemmas than the control group.
Wow, those are some incredible examples. So how can teachers begin today to help students develop mindset?
Well, one of the simplest, most powerful strategies for helping students develop grit and a growth mindset is by being intentional about how we offer praise. There are basically three types of praise we can offer students: people praise, product praise, and process praise. Focusing on process praise is a great way to shift students' thinking about themselves and their work.
Okay, so can you explain what you mean by the different types of praise?
So let's start with people praise. Okay. People praise includes statements like, you're so smart, and you're so good at math. While those might sound helpful, research has shown that this kind of praise actually decreases a student's motivation. By now, most people have heard about Carol Dweck's study, which showed that students who had consistently received people praise were less likely to engage in challenging tasks, and their scores dramatically dropped the longer they received this type of praise. So product praise involves, as you can imagine, making positive observations about a student's output. So for example, your art project is beautiful, or your research paper is very well written. So again, these may seem like things we would want to say, but they've been shown to lead to a fixed mindset rather than a growth mindset. And then finally, process praise. It's more specific, and it emphasizes how a student has practiced the characteristics that help them with mindset, like grit, resilience, perseverance, patience, and critical thinking skills.
So what are some of these examples of process praise?
So you could say something like, I can see how you used some strategies we've learned and practiced in class. Or it's apparent that you put a lot of work into this project. Or you stuck with it even when it seems like it got hard. It can take time to adjust the type of praise we offer our students or our children. We may even want to have a sort of script or a card with a list of examples that sound natural to us.
Wow, that is extremely helpful and interesting. Thank you for joining us for this series over the IDOE social-emotional competencies. I know I've learned a lot, and I hope our listeners have as well.